Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
We are entering into Chinese New Year here. We're about to enter the year of the dog.
Leaving behind the year of the rooster.
Yeah, so, you know, we occasionally touch on Chinese and Eastern topics throughout the year, but this is always a good time to really focus on a couple of really good ones. And right. That's what we have today.
Yeah, so the Lunar New Year is coming up on Friday, February 16th. Mm-hmm. And this week we're doing a couple of episodes related to Chinese culture and some technological and scientific tie-ins. And so today's episode is going to feature the bulk of it's going to be an interview we did with the author of a book about the history of the Chinese typewriter. The full title of the book is The Chinese Typewriter, A History, and it's published by MIT Press in 2017.
Yeah, it's available wherever you get your books. You can get it in digital form or print.
Now, Robert, you picked this book out. Well, what appealed to you about it?
Well, I basically received a release about it, about this book from Thomas S. Mulaney, who's an associate professor of Chinese history at Stanford University and curator of the international exhibition Radical Machines, Chinese in the Information Age. And I really hadn't thought about this before, but I instantly thought, yeah, well, you know, the Chinese language, Mandarin, Chinese characters, how does that fit into the information age? How has that fit into the information age? And so I said, well, let's get back to that. Let's read this book and see what it has to offer. And it was a really mind-blowing read.
Yeah, really interesting in thinking about the ways that technology formed the substrates on which our languages evolve, and like this tension that's constantly existing with information technology. Does the technology change the way you use information, or will the way you use information shape the necessary features of technology? So we'll definitely be discussing that with Thomas Mulaney. But before we get into that, I think we should just address the issue behind the subject of the Chinese typewriter. Now, if somebody isn't familiar with the written version of Chinese, with Chinese characters, it might not be immediately apparent to them why the idea of a Chinese typewriter would be especially interesting.
Yeah, that's right, because you might just think, oh, well, we have our letters, they have their letters. Wrong. Chinese does not have an alphabet. Now, certainly you can write Chinese in, say, pinyin, which is a version of our Roman alphabet with accent marks added to let you know how the tones are to be pronounced. But for the most part, as Mulaney points out, you have this colonialism, globalization of language that spreads around the world, and it's based on that Roman alphabet. And then meanwhile, you have the Chinese with these characters that do not fit within that system. You can essentially think of it as a system of pictograms, but they're highly stylized pictures of what they represent. As many as 90% are compounds of a meaning element and a sound element.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just look at them and say, oh, that's a river, that's a robot, etc. They're far more complex than that. And I've read that you need to know somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 characters to get the basic gist of a Chinese newspaper. But you'd need to know between 2,000 and 3,000 characters to really get a sufficient understanding of the information. Meanwhile, a well-educated Chinese speaker in today's world likely knows 6,000 to 8,000 characters. And if you're wondering, well, where does that stand in terms of all the characters? Well, you can look at some of the major Chinese lexicons out there, and they're numbering in the tens of thousands. One figure I saw was 47,000 Chinese characters.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that Chinese speakers would recognize 47,000 characters when reading, in the same way that you might read, you know, a book of specialized terminology that has specialized words in English, and you wouldn't necessarily know what those words mean.
Right, yeah. Think of the thickest dictionary, English dictionary you've ever picked up, and think of all the words that that instantly don't resonate with you. And you'll have some sense of what we're looking at here.
But you do have this major difference in that in a language like English, you can look at a word and it's made out of letters that are familiar to you, even if the word isn't familiar to you. So even if you have no idea what a word means, you could almost instantly transcribe the word on a typewriter or keyboard or whatever. With Chinese characters, not necessarily the case.
That's right. And another thing I want to touch on here is that in China, you have eight major dialect groups, and we call these dialects, but as Mulaney points out, they're as mutually distinct as Portuguese and French in some cases. But Mandarin is the official language, of course, but still all these different dialects, they depend upon the Chinese character system. So whether you're talking about Mandarin or Cantonese, it's the same characters. But in practice, Cantonese adds, I think, about 3,000 specialized characters on top of that.
But think about the unifying influence of having characters like that. So you can have a country that is, you know, is considered a people, the Chinese people of the Chinese country, and they share a government. And in a sense, they share a language because they have these shared characters, even though they speak very, very distinct oral languages.
That's right. And then you enter this age where your internal system of communication, written communication, is at odds with what's really becoming kind of a global standard. And it's that tug of war that most of Mulaney's book focuses on.
All right then, Robert, are you ready to go to our interview with Thomas Mulaney?
Let's do it. All right, Tom, thank you for joining us on Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we have been reading your book, The Chinese Typewriter, A History. I suppose the first question I have for you here today is, when you talk to people about your book, do you encounter any of the key historic reactions to and prejudices against just the idea, the notion of a Chinese typewriter?
I would say all the time. It's what one of the things that was at first surprising, and then I had more time to think about it over the course of working on the book, was that the consistency with which people would imagine in their mind's eye what they assumed or expected a Chinese typewriter to look like. And in essence, regardless of where I was in the U.S. or in Europe or in Asia, including China in many cases, the assumption kind of led someone to the same expectation, which was a massive machine with thousands of keys on this gigantic keyboard. And what's surprising about this is that people arrive at this conclusion without necessarily or almost never having seen such an image. They just sort of create it algorithmically in their mind. And I think what I came to the, conclusion of is that the what's going on in our minds when we think about a Chinese typewriter is a kind of, it's like a mental algorithm. It's a very short computer program that runs in our mind, and it goes something like this. Well, I know that by definition, a typewriter is a machine with a keyboard and keys. I know that there is one key per letter. I know that Chinese doesn't have letters, it has characters. And I know that there are tens of thousands of characters, or I've heard that. Ergo, I've reached the conclusion about what in my mind's eye a Chinese typewriter looks like. And in the book, what I tried to do is say, now there is a total equation set up between keyboards, keys, and typewriters. There's no such thing as a typewriter without keys in the market and also in our imagination. But if we go back early enough in the history of the typewriter, including the Western typewriter, we very quickly get into this, you know, sort of amazing and very diverse kind of Jurassic ecology of typewriters, many different types of typewriters, including typewriters that had no keys or keyboards themselves. And that, in essence, the Chinese typewriter, which is a typewriter that has no keyboard and no keys, is a descendant of a sort of early species of typewriter that in the West died out, the typewriter with no keyboard, but in China, you know, lived on and continued its evolution. And so now when the two meet again in the year 1970, 80, 90, 2000, 2010, when someone from the descendants of the keyboard typewriter looks over and sees the descendant of the non-keyboard typewriter, they don't know what to make of it. They don't know what they're looking at.
So there's a concept you talk about in the book that you call the techno-linguistic dimensions of a language. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about what you mean by the techno-linguistic dimensions of a language. And so, for example, what are some of the techno-linguistic aspects of modern American English as a point of reference for our listeners? And then how do those same types of techno-linguistic dimensions inform the creation of the Chinese typewriter in history?
In essence, the techno-linguistic dimension is every part of writing text technology that is essential for writing to work and for text technologies to function, but that are not simply superficially on the page or on the screen, the stuff we read. And so to give an example, I remember earlier when I was in the early stages of working on this project, I'm a big believer in kind of practice-based theory. So take classes and things and really try to understand the processes and machines you're thinking about, because insight will emerge in that. And so I enrolled in this intensive letterpress practicum, so movable typesetting, and for English, because I wanted to step into, you know, this space that there are obviously many, many practitioners of, even today, but certainly over history, and just see what it looks like. And there was one, it was an amazing, I took it at the San Francisco Center for the Book. It was just absolutely tremendous. But there's one thing in particular that stayed with me, which is might seem incidental to someone who is in that world for a long time. And that is when you or I look at a printed poster or a book or an article or whatever it is, and we see the text block in the middle of the page, and then we see the margins, the 1-inch margins on the left and right, top and bottom. I would venture to guess that you, as I, we see emptiness, we see space, we see there is nothing there. Yes, there's paper, but that's not where the text is. And so if you just stopped there, it would be easy to imagine that it really is made up of nothingness. There's nothing there. That's not where language happens, and so forth. When you go through the process of learning, in this case, letterpress, you realize that you actually have to build emptiness. You have to build space on the page, quite literally, with pieces of metal. So if you want there to be spacing between the lines, you need letting. And this is not just a digital term in our Adobe platform. This is a thin sliver of metal whose dimensionality will give you so much space between the lines. And then you use these various sized pieces of wood, sometimes referred to as furniture, that you build up around the block of text that you're going to situate on the page. You lock it in there really tight with these things called coins that you kind of put in place and then kind of jack into position and hold it onto the type bed so it doesn't wiggle around when you're printing. And then you put, you ink it and you pull the paper through, and then it comes out on the other side, and there you have it, a text block with 1-inch margins and so much space and emptiness and so much text, like black on white. And suddenly your view of space, or at least for me, the view of space changed radically. It takes a lot of stuff to make nothing happen. It takes a lot of, and these pieces of wooden furniture, they don't have writing on them. I can't read a piece of these wooden blocks. So they're not operating in the same kind of heuristic interpretive space as the actual, let's say it's a poem by or an essay or a broadside that I can read and think about and debate. And maybe it's a love letter or a wedding invitation. All of this stuff that's so full of meaning in the classic sense of the word. Well, there's all of this meaninglessness, like these wooden pieces of thing, like these flats of metal that have to, for letting. There's all of this meaninglessness that goes into making that meaning work, whether it's a wedding invitation or an iconoclastic essay. That wood, that metal, is for me part of this admittedly very large category of technolinguistic. It's all of the stuff, but also all of the mental models, categorization systems, workflows and processes and things that go into making something work on the page. Experts, practitioners, people in these industries, they know these things. I mean, it's second nature for them. So it's not as if I discovered the lost city of Atlantis, but if they do their job well, and if they succeed in their goal is to keep that stuff invisible. You don't want a badly printed poem that kind of show, maybe to get some ink got on one of those pieces of wood and it accidentally inked the page. Well, that's failure. That means it didn't work out. You want that technolinguistic stuff to remain invisible. But for myself, as an historian of language change, of text technologies, especially of a family of text technologies on the Chinese side that, as I argue in the book, have been placed in this very asymmetric, unequal position in the global history of information technology. We, as historians of information technology, we really do need to pay attention to that meaninglessness, because oftentimes it's in the space of the meaninglessness, not the stuff that's on the page, the poem itself, where the action is. Sometimes it is, but it's not necessarily in the poem where the action is. It might actually be in the stuff around the poem that makes that poem printable, transmittable, savable in the first place. An example from Asia that I really like to show actually comes from Japan. There's this wonderful YouTube video that shows a turn-of-the-century Japanese automaton, a calligraphy automaton. It is constructed to look like a Chinese woman with a brush in hand, and when the gears move, the automaton composes a really beautifully wrought Chinese character, a kanji character. And the video shows, I think it's newscasters, it's part of a news broadcast in Japan, contemporary, maybe a few years ago, showing people, like oohing and aahing about this. And everyone is paying attention to what's happening on the page, the character, and what it looks like as it comes out. But then in the end of the video, and also behind the automaton, for me is where the actual action is. they show the carefully carved series of really woobly and wobbly wooden camshafts that are tucked away in the back of and the base of the automaton, that when this kind of it's kind of hard to describe, but when this guiding almost like a record player arm and needle is tracing over these camshafts as they turn, it's translating. The machine is translating the shape of those camshafts into the movement of the automaton, which is then producing this perfect character on the page. For me, those wooden camshafts, the construction of them, the figuring out what shape each one needs to be and what sequence and how do we build this device that translates it into a character, that to me is actually the location of language. But if we were to take those camshafts, you know, disassemble the machine and I just hand you a bunch of, they look like wooden plates, but they're not perfectly circular. They've got a woobly, wobbly kind of edge. If I just handed them to you and said, what character is this? What Japanese character is this? You couldn't read it. The only way that it produces that character is in this careful sequence. So this is, for me at least, this is really interesting. Those wooden camshafts, you know, crafted by hand and at the, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, these camshafts are not a representation of that character, of that Japanese character that comes out the other side. They quite literally are that character when assembled in a particular sequence. So that's to me is the techno-linguistic. It is this vast space of expert action and care and attention and practice, but it's not something you can just simply read in a naked eye sense the way that we might be able to read an essay or a poem and debate about it. But all of this meaninglessness, this uninterpretability, is what makes language work. Without it, language just ceases to function in any language, Chinese, English, Japanese, you name it.
That explanation almost makes me think of like the base pairs or the gene that generate a phenotype in an animal, that we only interact with the external phenotype unless you're a, you know, genetic engineer or researcher, but that the thing in the external world is literally generated by this, you know, behind the scenes code.
I think that's right. It's something that if you were just, you just look at it at the face of it. And this is true in, you know, this is true in the realm of, certainly in the realm of early computing and contemporary computing. The, you know, if we experience our MacBook Pros the way that we do because of the success of a series of engineers and product designers who went out of their way to conceal as much as possible what's really going on. So when I type the letter, when I depress the key that has the symbol that I recognize as S or G or H on it, and then it appears on the screen, it happens so fast that I can kind of live inside the fantasy, live inside the fiction that, in essence, this thing is just like a digital typewriter. It's just I push it, it translated some motion, and then it printed it on the page. But, of course, that's not how it works. I mean, there's all of these translations going on to get from point A to point double Z. There's regulations and coding standards, and then quite literally, you know, physical logic gates and so that space, if you were just to take away the key that says F and take away the screen that basically all the screen is doing is showing you that the bitstream worked. But imagine what it looks like if you take away the screen and take away the symbols on the keys. What exactly is the letter S at that point? It's still there. If you were to push the button and the computer is on, it would still be doing what it's supposed to be doing. But the kind of circuit of interpretation that the human needs would not be complete. I would not know whether or not what letter I had typed. So what I'm interested in, I mean, I'm not to the exclusion of the surface parts of language, but I think I want to include these spaces of language, which like the genotype-phenotype relationship, are happening in this completely dark room. How do we think about the genotype without recourse to the phenotype? Might be one way to put it, but I'm not sure if that gets us any further.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more with Thomas Mullaney.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene. Last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Jean. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Jean, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return. Your time won't. And we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So to many Westerners, Mandarin Chinese presents certain challenges. Chinese characters present certain challenges, to say the least. But can you explain some of the challenges that Chinese characters were seen to pose to China itself in the 19th and 20th centuries?
Definitely. There were many. Many problems that were sort of deservedly laid at the feet of Chinese character writing, and some that I think a sober analysis of history would say was an unfair thing to blame characters for. There's a series. One of them would certainly be that in the late 19th century into the early 20th century, China is undergoing, like many polities on Earth around this time, is undergoing a transition, and it's an uneasy one, a transition between one form of organizing political power and statecraft. And it's kind of wrapped up in the nutshell of the word empire, to a republic. And so, you know, this takes a revolution to happen. It arguably takes a civil war to complete this transition. But one part of this transition was a radical reconceptualization of where legitimacy for state rulers derives. The shift from the derivation from heaven of the right to rule to a shift, at least in people, you know, in the argument, to the people, whatever this word means. Well, one of the issues, and this happens in many of these sort of empire to nation state transitions, is that people say, well, we need more of our people to be involved or part of this political enterprise that we're in. They're no longer subjects. They should now be educated, literate, participating, economically participating, politically participating actors. And one of the major barriers, and this is the argument that's being made at the turn of the century, is that Chinese character-based writing places people in China at such a comparative disadvantage to those in alphabetic contexts. And so there's many, many reformers, education reformers, political reformers that are making this case. Some of them, a very small number of them, I say, would arrive at the extreme notion that the solution to this problem is simply getting rid of characters altogether and replacing them with another script. A great many more within society tried to figure out new techniques, new pedagogies by which to introduce more Chinese students and readers to what they understood as the core vocabulary, the basics of Chinese. And there's a lot of stuff that was surrounding issues of literacy. For a number of the actors that I deal with in my book, they care about mass education, mass literacy, very much, but they also care about things like how do you design a card catalog system for books in Chinese for our new public libraries that we're designing. So if I walk up to a card catalog and I want to find a book by a particular author or a particular title, what is the best way to sequence or organize Chinese character writing so that someone can find it as quickly as possible? They're often, again, comparing with the alphabets. They say, look how easy the alphabet, it's A through Z. There's no ambiguity about where you put, you know, Alfred versus Zimbabwe. It's very simple. In Chinese, there is no one set way of organizing dictionaries, phone books, name lists, and so forth. And so in the 1920s, there is a kind of knock 'em sock 'em debate, which involves library scientists and mass education people, and it's like a full blown kind of press event where they argue with one another about the best way to organize telephone books and library card catalogs and the indexes of books and name registers and all of these things. And the argument is made that because Chinese doesn't have a self-evident A through Z sequence, and because modern capitalist economies and also modern republican states really require fast information retrieval, that China is operating in kind of slow motion as compared to the rest of the world, because every time we need to recall a file from a database, it takes us a few seconds longer than it does to recover an equivalent from somewhere in the alphabetic world. And if you take those thousands, tens of thousands, millions of acts of information retrieval, and if each one of them takes a few seconds longer than their counterpart, and you add them all up, and suddenly we're kind of operating in this slow motion as compared to the rest of the world. So it's a really fascinating idea about that these theorists had about where China's problems were coming from. Some people were arguing at the scale of war and scaling it, and arguing at the scale of empire and colonialism. But there's this subset of people who are arguing that, in essence, China's problems are derived from millions of tiny increments of delay, and that it's our job as reformers, as Chinese reformers, to find a way to close that gap and speed up the language so that we can operate in a global, you know, a global economy and so forth. So there's probably 20 more examples of critiques of Chinese character writing, but that's probably a nice dyad, one that is operating at the space of, you know, the ability to read and debate and argue and engage in interpretation and read those poems and read essays. And then the other side, which I think is more along the lines of the techno-linguistic discussion in the book, which is people fighting over how to organize this language in space and time.
So that's really interesting. It makes me think about the way that you talk about the two different approaches to making Chinese characters compatible with modern labor-saving technology, like the typewriter, but not just the typewriter, these other things you mentioned, card catalogs and everything. And there are essentially two ways to go about it. You mentioned in the book, you can try to adapt the technology to the language, like maybe Remington tried to do in the example you give, where they have this phonetic alphabet for Chinese on their typewriter, but no one would use it. Or you could adapt the technology to the language. What are some examples you see of the most, or maybe not most successful, but the major efforts in both of these camps through the 20th century?
I think that's exactly right. And so these these attempts to the debate for many was, you know, who has to change? Is it Remington that has to come and meet Chinese, or is it Chinese that needs to meet Remington? And the way that the history plays out, and also the way it's still playing out, is that these two are locked in a kind of never-ending cycle, a never-ending dialectic that is still playing its way out, is playing itself out. And so the example from the book that you mention of basically just trying to bring the language into a Remington more or less, with the Remington more or less untouched, is the case of the Chinese phonetic alphabet. And it just simply doesn't take off. It doesn't work. Remington and many other companies have fundamentally misunderstood what the Chinese phonetic alphabet was supposed to do, what it was made to do, since it was invented by Chinese linguists, but it was never meant to replace Chinese character-based writing. But they kind of harbored this dream that, yeah, maybe that's not why it was invented, but we all know that Chinese characters will eventually disappear, and we're hoping that this is the thing that puts the final nail in the coffin, which is not what happened. But it's in the tension between those two more simple means of trying to solve the puzzle. And one of the reformers put it really clearly when he said that Chinese characters are innocent. Chinese characters are innocent, or Chinese characters have committed no crime. And he goes on to say, this is an overseas Chinese student in the 19-teens who goes on to become an engineer and to develop the prototype of the first mass-manufactured typewriter for Chinese. And he says, you know, and more or less any engineer worth the title would never want or never expect the world to change to make their job easier. Like, that's not the engineer's role in existence. It is to take the world as it is, or at least start from that vantage point, and then try to think outside of preconceptions to meet the world where it is. So in this case, the Chinese language can take part in the in this newest iteration of the information revolution. And the maybe one place that is a good example of an attempt to meet each other halfway was an experimental Chinese typewriter. It was never mass manufactured, but it was fully conceived and prototyped by another overseas Chinese student who was working at NYU in the 19-teens. And he develops a prototype Chinese typewriter in which the goal was to figure out how to quote unquote spell Chinese piece by piece on the page. And I put spell in scare quotes because he did not mean phonetically. He did not mean, okay, instead of writing the two characters for Beijing, the city of Beijing, I'm going to write B-E-I-J. He didn't mean that. What he meant was, can we subdivide all Chinese characters into existence and discover the underlying repeating modular shapes, these little pieces of characters that continually show up in every character that exists? And if we can reduce Chinese to a set of these modular shapes and then put those shapes onto keys or onto type bars, or in this case, he makes it into a cylinder that's inside the machine, then one could fit tens of thousands of characters onto a machine simply by shattering them into pieces. And then the user would have to sit down at the machine and compose the desired character module by module. And so it's an incredible idea, and it's related to the Western alphabetic notion of spelling a word. You know, the word cat is not on our typewriter. We have C and A and T, and therefore we do have cat on our typewriter. It's the same kind of concept, but abandoning or leaving behind the phonetic part of that and just saying, okay, we're not caring about the sound of it. We care about the ability to build up something on the page. So this, if you look at this, this is neither 100% trying to take the typewriter and make it serve or subordinate it to Chinese writing. It's still trying to build a machine that looks like a Western typewriter. But at the same time, it's also not simply 100% taking Chinese writing and subordinating it to a Remington. It's trying to meet the problem somehow halfway and in essence saying, okay, both parties are going to have to give something up. I don't know if that's the right word, or are going to have to be willing to really reimagine what you consider to be canonical first principles. So in Chinese, we have to give up the idea that the character is the base of our language, that the character is the fundamental unit of our language. It isn't. In this machine, it's going to be the pieces of characters that are the fundamental units. And if people are willing to accept that, i.e. learn how to use this machine in this way, then you can have all the characters you want. If you're unwilling to think that way, that's another issue. And then vis-a-vis the, I mean, this is sort of a diplomatic negotiation metaphor, but vis-a-vis the Remington, you know, delegation, saying to them, listen, you know, you're going to have to give up on the idea of sound and phonetics and the sounding out of words. That's not how this machine works. These symbols are not going to be letters of any alphabet. Technically speaking, it's not an alphabet we're talking about. It's a set of modular shapes. But we can still, you know, think of the typewriter. But you don't have to give up on your idea of a typewriter as you know it. More or less, it's kind of the typewriter you know. And this machine in its day and age doesn't win the day. It doesn't gain mass manufacturing support. But arguably, this idea of how to treat characters, how to quote unquote fit them into digital spaces, is very much alive and well even today. In fact, it's kind of made a comeback as one of the dominant ways of thinking of writing. When typeface designers, those, you know, when practitioners or companies that are building a font, a digital font for Chinese, they often, the team that builds a Chinese font often thinks in these terms. They don't think, okay, I'm going to draw every Chinese character from scratch, which would take, you know, would take years and years, and I'm going to scan them, and I'm going to create my Bezier curves, and I'm going to do all this sort of stuff. They say, what are the pieces and modules that make up characters? Let's focus to a certain extent at that level, and voila, the work that we did on this piece has a multiplier effect because this module shows up in 50 other characters or 100 characters or 1,000 characters. So that's one of the, I mean, that's the fascinating thing about history in general, but history of information technology in particular is it is completely nonlinear, and something that was last off the stage 80 years ago can suddenly in a different ecology be the way to do something. Yeah, and so I think that might be a good example. That's the story of the young overseas Chinese student I deal with in the early part of the book.
I love in the book how you explore this this sort of middle path, this attempt to find this compromise, and at one point you compare it to Charybdis and Scylla, the sea monster in the whirlpool. I love this exploration of how on one end you don't want the machine to change or limit the language and the culture, but then on the other side, there's this reluctance to create something that will look like the monster machine that some are expecting a Chinese typewriter to be.
I like thinking in terms of agony. And what I mean by agony is something to the extent of, I don't know, imagine you're an international transoceanic pilot and you know, you've got 300 passengers on board and, you know, you're going over the sea, and maybe under certain circumstances, if you chose, you could just you don't feel well, whatever, you just hand over controls to your co-pilot. Short of these two people, there's no one else to hand over controls to. There is this space of having to stay within a condition of anxiety, contradiction, irresolvability. And in essence, it's that kind of staying in ambiguity, staying in uncertainty, that is probably the shared characteristic among the actors in the book. In a certain sense, that's intentional, and it's also, I'm trying to make an intervention because there are other actors, much more famous actors in Chinese history, who receive, you know, the lion's share of attention when it comes to questions of the Chinese language and modernity and technology and stuff. And these are figures that I talk about in the introduction of the book who made these really sweeping, iconoclastic statements that we should just get rid of characters altogether and use English or use French or use Esperanto. And they sound so iconoclastic and sexy and rebellious. And really, they're naive. I mean, the statements that they're making are completely ridiculous at one level. Simplistic and in many ways naive. I mean, clearly there are societies on Earth that have undertaken massive transformations in their orthographies, but the idea that China as a whole was going to just cut ties with writing it sounds good on paper. It gets the attention certainly of contemporaries and even more so scholars of China after the fact. But what it obscures is that, A, those guys didn't win. You know, Chinese characters are with us. Chinese IT is booming. You know, so the prognosis that they were giving in the years 1900 through 1920 did not pan out, and yet we still assign their essays in all of our classes. There is this other kind of motley crew of individuals, you know, most of them Chinese or Chinese descent, but also engineers and linguists and entrepreneurs all around the world. They're stuck, and they understand that they're stuck. We're not going to just get rid of Chinese and go the alphabet, and therefore we can all buy IBMs, and that's the benefit of us severing this. We're not going to do that, but we want IBMs, we want mainframes, we want microcomputers, we want telegraphy, we want these things, or in a more selfish way, we want to be the company that gives this to the Chinese market because we want to make money. You know, that's there as well. But they're staying in this space of agony between where there's no way out. They have to stay in this and think in that space. You know, I often don't think in terms of historical success or like when do the strings come in and when are the lovers reunited? But the lovers reunited is in essence at the end of the book because the practice and the concept of input that is baked in an early form into Lin Yutang's experimental 1940s typewriter, the Ming Kuai, that way of building a typewriter is something that is born out of that tension, that agony, that irresolvability that all of these individuals are living in for decades. I mean, arguably, I mean, not just any one individual, but as a cast of characters, there are people that are living in that space for a century and a half. They're not giving in to easy, iconoclastic, flashy statements, but neither are they saying, well, I guess we should pack it up and go home. We can't take part in this new iteration of the global information revolution. They're just staying in that space. And so I have admiration not because of what they build or that they made money or that they're, you know, in the sort of romantic sense, but that staying in that kind of space is not a very rewarding thing. You know, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of people in the story are really in that space. And that's where, and also just to bring it back a little bit to the discussion of technolinguistic, the technolinguistic space is where this motley crew is focusing most of their attention. They're saying to themselves, to the world, okay, we want to keep Chinese characters. What does that mean exactly? What that means is that when we pick up a book in 20 years in China, we want to see Chinese characters. When someone sits down, goes to the telegraph, the post office and wants to send a telegram, we want it that the sender can write this out in Chinese and that the recipient, when they receive it, can receive something in Chinese with Chinese characters in it. Like, let's be very specific about what we mean about preserving the language. And then the next kind of collective statement out of their mouth is, okay, what are we willing to blow up and totally dismantle and rebuild in radical new ways in order to achieve that effect? And the stuff that they're willing to blow up and build and be iconoclastic with regards to is mainly the stuff that is, I use this metaphor in the book, it's like it's under the street, it's in the sewage system, it's in the walls, the electrical and the air conditioning system, it's in the way that the library card catalogs are organized. It's in the way that we break down characters and we put them into pieces inside a machine. It's lots and lots and lots of stuff. But if we're successful, the user, let's say, or the recipient of the message won't necessarily have to worry about that stuff. They'll still be able to experience the Chinese character writing environment. It's not glorious work, you know. It's not the space of poetry. It's the space of the predecessor of arguing over the Unicode, you know, Unicode regulations and protocols and stuff. It's technical dogged work, but they're convinced, and ultimately they prove it to be so. They're convinced that that's the place where Chinese can be preserved and saved.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will have more of our interview with Thomas Mullaney.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you ride the books, Gene, and last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Could you talk a little bit about the relationship of politics and values to what could be written on some historical incarnations of the Chinese typewriter? Like, I'm thinking of the machines with limited numbers of character slugs and how the inclusion and placement of the character slugs could be influenced by anything, I guess, whoever's designing it, maybe Christian missionary zeal or Maoist ideology. And then as a second part, do you think that's unique to the history of the Chinese typewriter, or are there ways that politics and values influence what can be done on other composition and printing devices, even alphabetic ones?
The Chinese typewriter that ends up being mass manufactured and becomes the quintessential model for Chinese typewriters is the common usage Chinese typewriter. And for this machine, in essence, the compromise at play is, okay, how do we fit all tens of thousands of characters on this machine? The answer is we don't. The answer is what we should be doing is a rigorous, almost proto-digital humanities, distant reading analysis of as big of a corpus of Chinese text as possible. We should be counting the number of times every single one of our characters appears, and then do a frequency analysis. And based on that frequency analysis of tens of thousands of characters, we should figure out what is the minimum number of characters that we would need for the maximum amount of utility, all with the understanding that in this mode, we can't have it all. We can't have all of our characters on the machine. So the outcome of this is the common usage machine, which by the midpoint of the 20th century gives the user a tray bed with 2,450 characters on it, so roughly 2,500, which is a small percentage of the tens of thousands of characters that exist, but as they figured out through these statistical analyses, which are all done by hand, that these account for 85 or more percent of everything that you're going to need it for. And then, so now this raises interesting possibilities and questions with regard to politics and politics of language, because once you start saying that not all characters get on the machine, the question naturally emerges, well, who decides and what's the basis for deciding who's in and who's out? And if something is out, what does that do from the user's perspective in terms of what they write? So A is that the politics are alive and well. One of my favorite examples, there's, I guess, two from the political realm. From the perspective of early Chinese Republicans, those who wanted to overthrow the empire and found a republic, and revolutionaries, one of the bad guys of Chinese history is the first de facto president of the republic after the revolution, this gentleman, Yuan Shikai, who comes from a military background, and he's understood as having betrayed the revolution, because shortly after the revolution of 1911 overthrows the final dynasty in China and establishes a republic, this fella, under the counsel of his entourage, decides to reestablish empire, and he names himself an emperor, and it causes another more or less kind of small scale civil war. And anyway, He dies a natural death, and then he leaves China in this political vacuum that gives rise to what's called the warlord period, where there's no central authority. He's not a beloved figure by many revolutionaries. So what's interesting is that when you get to tray beds of Chinese typewriters in the early 20s, his name, the characters that make up his name, are not on the tray bed. They're kind of stuck in what's called the secondary usage box of characters, which is a wooden box that contains a few more thousand characters that the typist can use if they need a character that's not on the tray bed. They just use a pair of tweezers, they pluck it out of the wooden box, they put it on the tray bed, and then they go ahead and use it. You know, this could, in a certain sense, this could be accidental. Not all the characters in his name are as common as others, but some are not uncommon. But there are these decisions that the designers of these machines get to make about what to include and what not, and often for political reasons. So the same typewriter engineer who leaves this man's name the characters that make up this man's name off the machine, puts his name, the characters that make his name, onto the common usage tray bed, even though the characters in his name are very uncommon. So that's kind of like the 1980s when computer programmers would leave little messages in the comments field of programs that they were making. It's sort of the designer's prerogative to leave their signature as they will. A more extreme example comes from the 1949 revolution, the communist revolution, and this one's a bit more subtle. The tray bed, the 2,450 characters that the user has in front of him or her, they're organized according to basically, let's call it, dictionary organization, a way of organizing characters that would have been familiar to anyone using them. But they were also further subdivided into most common characters, and those were in the very center of the tray bed, and then second most common characters, which were on the left and right flank of this rectangular matrix. And the idea, quite simply, was because you had to go from one character to the next, to the next, to the next, you want to group and cluster and clump together common usage characters as close as possible. So, you know, we really want that centerpiece, that center part of the tray bed, to have as many of the most frequent characters as possible. Well, in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, prior to the Communist Revolution, The character Mao, which by itself means a follicle of hair, like hair on your head, is a very common character, but it's not the most common of characters. So it was on the right flank of the tray bed. Well, after the 1949 revolution, that character was promoted, basically. It was moved from the flanks of the machine to this centermost, most common region. And for obvious reasons, that this is the surname of Mao Zedong, of Chairman Mao, whose name, engineers rightly understood, was going to be in lots and lots and lots of texts. And so suddenly it becomes easier for a typist, faster for a typist, to produce his name. You know, the question often comes, I often encounter the question, do I think that these dimensions cycle back into what the user is doing and basically, you know, shape what it is that they're writing? Do our technologies shape what we write? And the answer, I think, in a kind of first principles way, is undoubtedly yes. It's undoubted that when you create different levels of difficulty and time to produce one word versus another word, that this kind of, in an economics of energy sense, cycles back into how we use those technologies. The real challenge is, how do we study that methodologically so that we don't simply, you know, find in our research a foregone conclusion? That's a very, very, very hard thing to think of as an historian. Like, how would I actually put that hypothesis to the test? You know, because then you'd have to really build a research program that would allow you to do that. One way that's possible is in the 1950s and 60s, Chinese typewriters were increasingly used to publish books and articles. So someone would use mimeograph paper, produce a master copy of a text, and then with a mimeograph machine would create a run of maybe anywhere from 10 to 150 in the hundreds. And this was a perfect kind of technology. This was a niche that the typewriter plus mimeograph was perfect for, because if you're going to publish only 100 copies of a book, you don't want a printing press. It's just too much overhead for too little output. But neither do you want to write that stuff by hand. So anyway, in these books, which I've amassed this collection of, you can see that whenever the typist encountered a word or a character or a series that was not on the machine, he or she would simply skip ahead and leave spaces there and then write it in by hand onto the mimeo paper and then produce the book. So you could actually see, A, which characters were not on this person's machine, and how often or how willing the typist was to do this, to leave spaces and then enter a word. Now the question would be, is that over time, are there fewer of these handwritten insertions? Are there more handwritten insertions? And if there were fewer handwritten insertions over time, this is kind of building a research program on the fly here, if there were fewer insertions over time, it would be reasonable to hypothesize that typists are using the strategy of basically synonym replacement. It's like, well, I don't have that word, which is not in there. Let me just replace it with a synonym or leave it out in favor of a character that is here. Because we know that the typewriter itself never changed size. You only have 2,500 to deal with. It's not as if they grew over time, and that's what would account for the lack of insertions. So you'd have to figure out how to actually submit this to the acid bath of reason. But I do think that on a first principles basis, it's undoubted that this feedback loop exists. It's hard to imagine that it could not exist.
This is kind of silly, but I kind of can't help but wonder if the availability of emojis is shaping our language or the way we think, like what you have an emoji for and what you don't have an emoji for.
I think that's true. And also animated GIFs. If you think about someone who wants to articulate something, I mean, think about Twitter and the number of times that some political figure says something and it's so befuddling that instead of the person bothering to articulate what is it about this statement by said political figure that is ridiculous or causes cognitive dissonance or it's a contradiction or it's illogical, instead it's a post of a 2-second clip of some famous actor, looking befuddled at the camera, and that's it. And that's like, as if that captures it. I think that's what I'm getting at there with this, with economy of expression. I mean, one is, takes time, and it's hard, and you have to, and you're sticking your neck out there to figure out how to put this into words, and how do I get my feeling, which is going on in my mind, that this is an illogical statement, and how do I make the argument that it is? That's an afternoon, you know. that takes a whole day, a whole week, a whole month to figure out how to put it, and it's so fast, and you got to get it out there because there's going to be another illogical statement any second now. So, might as well just take. And now, of course, the fact that these animated GIFs are preloaded into the technology, let me just find a preloaded one that is spacious enough and ambiguous enough that I can encode my feeling in it, and then I'll post that instead. And it takes me, you know, all of 5 seconds. There's that dimension of it. So that's one where it's cycling into expression and also the capacity to express, because it takes good, you know, a good book isn't written, it's rewritten. A good writer is basically a good editor, is what they really are. And so if you never learn how to edit and how to revise and how to, then can you become a good writer? That's probably not, but it's open for question, I guess. The other part is archivability. If someone takes the time, even if they fail, you know, even if their argument doesn't hold, if they take the time to express why they found some statement illogical or shocking or whatever it might be, whatever the case might be, well, it exists in a textual form that can be attributed to a person and a time and a place. How in the world is an historian in the year 2300, or, you know, 2300, if it exists, going to cite, I don't know, the animated GIF A that was used 700,000 times in 20,000 different scenarios as a way of trying to articulate what people in the year, whatever, 2018 thought? It almost, you know, and these are the reverberations of technologies of expression, technologies of writing that we don't have to deal with. But of course, someone will, maybe.
All right, Tom, it looks like we're out of time here, but we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with us. Really enjoyed the book. It's a great read for people that are interested in Chinese history, the history of technology, linguistic technology, linguistics itself. So thanks for chatting with us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
All right, so there you have it. Thanks again to Thomas Mullaney for chatting with us about his book, The Chinese Typewriter. Again, it's out from MIT Press. You can get that in print. You can get it as a digital ebook, however you like to consume your media. And he's not stopping here. The next book in the series is going to be The Chinese Computer.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and he teased it a little for us, kind of off mic, but it's going to involve not only some of the agencies that were involved in the first book, but also the U.S. government and sort of the espionage world of the Cold War as well.
Yes, we will go deeper and deeper into the realms of composition surrogacy. If you're curious what that means, check back in with The Chinese Computer in the future.
In the meantime, be sure to head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, blog posts, links out to various social media accounts, etc. And on the landing page for this episode, we will be sure to link out to a place where you can buy Mullaney's book as well as Mullaney's profile at Stanford.
Thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. And if you want to get in touch with us to let us know your feedback on this episode or any other, or if you'd like to, request a topic for the future, something that interests you, you think might interest us and the other listeners as well, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.